hope you're ready for this. Thank you, Mary. Okay, I'm Lisa and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink of alcohol or any mind-altering chemicals in my body since September 7th, 1977. That's the most important day of my life. I have just got through telling you probably the most important things that I'm going to say the whole time I'm up here. And I've also just gotten through telling you all of the things that I really know for certain about me or about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything else I say from this point on is going to be one of three things. It's either going to be something that I learned from my experience, which applies to me and me only, and it's welcome for you to share if you would like to, or it's going to be something from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or from another piece of AA literature, and if it is, you'll find it there. And if it's not either of those two things, it's just going to be, you know, some kind of flaky opinion of mine, and you're just real free not to listen to that. So if you disagree with some of the things I say, don't feel uncomfortable. When I share my story, I share what works for me. And when I talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I don't specifically say so all the time, that I want you to know that I mean the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that works in my life, and I'm not saying that it's necessary for you to work it exactly that way. I'm really very grateful to the committee for inviting me to this conference. This has been a beautiful experience so far, and I know it's not going to do anything but get better. I was going to open this talk with a joke, and I was thinking about it last night, just as Tom was beginning to talk, and he had just introduced himself, and in my mind I was thinking about this joke that a friend of mine in Oklahoma had told me, and he said, you know, you should open your talk with a joke. This is a good joke for you to open your talk with. He told me this joke, and as I was sitting there thinking that I would probably open my talk with that particular joke, Tom began to tell it, and it was very good, so I don't have my joke. So I guess we'll have to dispense with that. It just really feels good to be sober today. I'd also like to tell you that I consider myself to be a happy person today. And that's a new thing in my life. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I certainly wasn't expecting to become a happy person. And I certainly wasn't expecting many of the things that I've received from this program. It's been so good just to have the experience of little by little through my own mistakes coming to a closer relationship with the God of my understanding and a closer relationship with those of you that I've had the opportunity to know, and to a closer relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. Because there is a certain closeness that I feel in rooms like this, and it seems real strange to me when I'm not standing up here to think that I can feel close to a whole room full of people, you know? And I may not feel that way when I first stand up here. I know by the time I sit down that I feel like that each one of you has been a little part of my life just by being here, and I want to thank you for that. You know, you may not think that you're important at this meeting, and you may not think you're important at this conference, but if none of you came, I'd look pretty funny standing up here. So, you know, just remember that you are important, and we're all important. Here. We're all a part of the Fellowship by the Sea. Most of you can probably tell by looking at me that I'm pretty young, and I don't know if that has anything to do with anything or not. Those of you that think this is the Alateen meeting, you can leave now because it's not. If you came for that, I'm real sorry that you got up this early in the morning for nothing. Because this isn't the Alateen meeting. It was really neat. This lady came up to me. I had a new experience today. It's sort of traditional. Every time I go to a conference somewhere to speak, usually four or five people will come up to me and ask me, oh, you're the Alateen speaker. And this lady came up, and usually that kind of irritates me because, you know, we're real sensitive. At the age that I'm at, you know, usually nobody wants to be, I don't want people to think that I'm 16 or 17. And, you know, I had a neat experience yesterday that, you know, the traditional lady came up to me and asked me if I was the Alateen speaker. And for the first time, I was kind of proud that she thought I was the Alateen speaker. I guess that shows you I'm getting older or something. But I don't know if age is important or not. I'll let you decide that for yourself. When I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not come into a young people's group. I did not learn sobriety from young people. I've shared sobriety with many young people, and they're a very important part of my life. And so are the old-timers in AA. And so are all the new people that come in of any age. And although we may not like the same kind of music, I think that we do need to apply the same principles in our life if we want to live sober and be useful, happy people. That was really all I wanted out of AA. When I came to AA, I walked into my first meeting and I looked around and I saw some people, and there was about 50 of them, and they were walking around acting normal. And I immediately knew that I wasn't going to be able to act normal because I never had been able to. If I could have set down a goal for what I wanted out of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I would want the people in Alcoholics Anonymous to teach me to do would be to act normal. It doesn't sound like a very gratifying wish, but at that time it was really the most important thing in my life, because all of my life I tried so hard to just kind of, I always just kind of wanted to blend in, you know, and there was always some part of me that would just keep sticking out, you know, and there was just a desire to just be like everybody else. I just wanted to be able to walk down the street and feel like I thought everybody else felt. I looked at them and their hair was always kind of laying down like this, and mine was always going out here and out there, you know, and I thought that just, you were just born that way. You know, I thought some people were just born with the ability to have all of their hair where they wanted it to be, and to have all of their shirts stay tucked in straight when they tucked them in, and to just come around looking like you'd put yourself together right and stayed that way. And I was one of those people that no matter what I did or no matter where I went, I always looked like I was falling apart, mentally and physically, you know. And I think that maybe the haphazardness of my appearance just conveyed the way my mind was, that it was just kind of an expression of my mind coming out to the outside, because that was the way my head was all the time. As early as I can remember, I was always thinking. And Tom last night said that wasn't a very good idea, and I agree. Sick thinking does not do a whole lot for a sick person. I used to think about a lot of things when I was a little kid, and I began to find out what was going on in the world. I had the misfortune of learning how to read at an early age, much before I was emotionally ready to comprehend what I was reading. It just hit me that there's not a clock in this room, and I forgot to borrow a watch. And this is a real emergency. Somebody needs to bring me a watch right now, because I don't have any sense whatsoever. And I will quit talking on time if I know what time it is. Thank you. That's really dumb. You know, I can do dumb things like that now. I don't have to worry about them. You know, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was perfect. And I know that. I used to think about my father being in Vietnam and what was going on over there. And I used to think about, you know, all of the things that I used to read in the paper about people being hungry and people being unhappy. And I used to wonder what I could do. And I sort of developed this kind of sick attitude that I should be doing something about these things. You know, and this was at the age of 8 or 10 years old. And I felt, I did not feel that I was incapable of doing something to help other people. Every time I tried, it seemed to backfire, though, and I really just wanted to be a part of somebody's life. I wanted to be a part of my family. I wanted to be a useful part. You know, it's hard when you think about it. You're always having things done for you, you know, when you're a kid. And I was raised in one of those families. My mother was worked like a horse when she was a kid, and she grew up and swore that she'd never do that to her children. You know, she'd never make them work like a horse. And so she had the opposite attitude with me, that I wasn't permitted to do anything for my own well-being. You know, I didn't learn how to wash clothes. I didn't learn how to cook food or, you know, do any responsibilities in the family. And partly as a result of that, I felt like that I was not important or that I was not cared about in my family. I had no conception of what love was. For some reason, I just lacked that understanding. You know, if somebody did something to show their care, if they did something, I just knew that if I was gone, they wouldn't miss me because they didn't need me for anything. I didn't do anything in the world that I could see that was important to them, except just be Lisa. And that was enough for them, but for me it wasn't enough, see, because I knew Lisa. And I didn't think Lisa was very much good. And the more that people told me that I was important and that I was loved, the more that people told me that I had great potential and that I was bright and that I was going to be somebody someday and that I was a really neat kid, the more people told me that, the more I became convinced that what I was a very bad person with a very good con job. And even though I grew more and more disgusted with people saying those things to me, I tried harder and harder to put up that image because my opinion of myself got lower and lower. And I, you know, I just don't have any idea why that was. I just felt like a nobody. And I considered suicide from a very early age. You know, I can't remember not thinking about suicide. I can't remember there being a time in my life where I did not think about dying, think about what it would be like to kill myself and whether it would be a good idea. It wasn't necessarily that I was thinking about it constantly. It was just always an option. Those things were always there. I don't remember my first drink. I have no idea when I took it. I know pretty much the first time I got drunk, and I can remember the first time I ever poured myself a drink. But I can't remember a time when I did not know what alcohol did. You know, I watched other people drink alcohol. It made them happy. You know, it was something that grown-up people did, and so it was special. And when I was about, I guess, 4 or 5 years old, I can remember going around and trying to get sips out of everybody's drinks just because it really, it wasn't that it tasted that great. Some of it did, some of it didn't. But it just gave me this nice, warm feeling inside. And later on in my life, I would read these children's books about witches and magic and, you know, stuff like that. And they would always have like a magic potion. There would be a magic potion that you would take. And to me, alcohol reminded me of that magic potion. There was something magic about it. There was something I didn't understand. It was in a glass, and it was cold, and it had ice in it. And then you put it in your mouth, and you drank it, and it just got hot. And it was like, wow, you know, this is so neat. And it made me feel just real nice inside. And all I had to do was take a couple of sips to get that nice feeling, and I didn't have a, you know, a compulsion to have any more, I don't think. I can remember getting in trouble a lot of times. Dad thought it was okay for me to have a few sips of his beer, and Mom did not think it was okay. So I can remember there being more than a few little tiffs over whether or not Lisa was going to get a glass of wine or whether or not Lisa was going to get a little bit of Daddy's beer. And I can remember that having happened all my life. The two parents, my mother and my father, whenever there was a question, their opinion was always opposite. And whenever there was a question that I had, their opinion was always opposite. They never agreed with each other on anything, and I felt that my family was like Mom over here and it was Dad over here, because you could never get the two of them together on anything. As long as you left them in opposite sides of the house, it was okay. And you could go ask Dad one question, he'd give you one answer. You could go ask Mom and she'd give you the opposite answer. So real quick I decided that one or the other of them was screwed up, and I, you know, kind of alternated between which one of them it was. And I also decided that I couldn't trust them, because I thought that they were supposed to know the answers. I thought that they were supposed to know the truth. You know, I thought that they were supposed to be able to tell me what to do. And my mother would tell me she knew what was best for me. And my father would tell me he knew what was best for me. And one or the other of them had to be lying, because why were they saying two different things? You know, so very early in life, I learned that if I was going to get information on what the world was like and what life was about, that I was going to go somewhere else besides to my parents. I also had a problem with trust. My idea of trust was that there was honest people and there was dishonest people, and that once you broke my trust once, you were out of my life forever, because there wasn't any chance that you would ever do right by me again. And a lot of times when a kid asks for information, when a kid asks where do babies come from, or when a kid asks what is my dad doing overseas, you tell them something that's not quite true. And I understand why you do that. I understand why I might do that, maybe. I hope not. But I might do that, maybe, if I had a little kid, if I didn't know, you know, the experiences I already knew. And then the little kid grows up and they read the newspaper and they find out that that's not so. And the kid goes, well, I'll never trust that person again because they lied to me. And it was the people that told me that they loved me, that tried so hard to hide the way things were for me, those were the people that I grew not to trust. And those people really did love me. But I learned that somehow I got lies and love all connected with each other. You know, and it's taken me a long, long time to not feel that when somebody says, I love you, that they're deceiving me, that they are about to deceive me, because those were the people that were close enough to me to really deceive me at a deep level where it counted. And when I had these experiences, I had just pretty much written off the whole world, because sooner or later you're going to catch everybody in a mistake. And once you made a mistake, I didn't want you in my life anymore because I couldn't trust you. So I felt very alone in the world. By the time I was 11 or 12 years old, I felt that there was no one in the world that I could ask for information, that I couldn't trust the newspapers, that I couldn't trust my parents, I couldn't trust the school, especially couldn't trust the teachers at school, you know, because they were just there to get paid. They'd tell you whatever the principal wanted them to tell you. You know, they couldn't say anything, you know, they couldn't really tell the truth, they'd get fired. And I just didn't trust anyone. And I was very lonely. I did not trust people that I did not know how to get close to people. I was so busy trying to... At this time, I didn't have any idea that there were any real feelings at all. I thought it all was a bunch of bull. And when I would try to have a relationship with somebody, when I would try to be a friend with somebody, I would listen to what other people said to their friends, and I would try to imitate that. I would try to say those same words out my mouth, whether I felt them or not, because I didn't know how to have the experience. All I could do was watch you and try to imitate what you did on the outside. And we all know that when we try to have a human relationship on a superficial level like that, that it doesn't work. I was playing at being a daughter. I would watch on TV and I would see the things that daughters said and I would try to say those things. And it all came out wrong and I didn't know why. And I was trying to be a kid at school and I would watch the kids at school and I would try to say the things they said. And it wouldn't come out right, and I didn't know why. You know, there wasn't anybody in the world that I would not have traded places with. I thought being Lisa was the worst person to be. I thought I was the only one that felt this way. And I didn't think that if somebody had told me just to be myself, I would have just, you know, I would have just thought they were crazy. I thought, if you knew what I was like, you wouldn't tell me that. You know, if you knew what I was like, you would say, well, I don't blame you for not wanting to be you. And it was with this kind of attitude that I began the drinking that eventually, the alcoholic drinking that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking with all of the sick attitudes that sometimes take some of us a lot of years of drinking to attain. I started drinking with those attitudes. The drinking, the physical, you know, material things that happen as a result of my drinking, I don't think they're very important. I can give you a real quick synopsis of my war story, as I call it. I had, I think, probably 6 part-time jobs before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Every one of those I lost either directly or indirectly as a result of my drinking and drug use. I had been expelled from school about 6 months before I came to AA, and as far as I knew at that time, they didn't have any intention of letting me back in. This was at the end of my sophomore year in high school. I had had an attendance record during my sophomore year in high school of 80% absence. And all I did all day was just get high. And I went to school because the truant officer would get me if I didn't go to school. And I mainly just went to school when I was too loaded to do anything else. I had been arrested once, and I had been in jail one time for a week before I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been in treatment center twice, and my parents helped me. They set me up to go there both of those times. I became a total addict. I was just, if you put something in front of me and told me that it would make me feel good, I'd do whatever you wanted me to do with it. You know, I'd eat it or stick it up my rear end or, you know, just do whatever you told me to do. If you told me it was going to make me feel better, I'd do it. You know, and I've had some weird things in my system. People have just walked up to me with little matchboxes full of, you know, full of something white and said, do some of this. And I never would ask. I didn't want to know what it was. You know, and if it was going to kill me, I didn't want to know. I just wanted to be surprised. You know, I thought that would be okay. Dying didn't scare me. You know, because one of the things I hated the most, more than anything else, is having it be morning and having to get up and go live another day. That was the most awful feeling that I ever had, was getting up. And sometimes, you know, I'd wake up and I'd still be kind of loaded, you know, so it'd be okay. But sometimes I'd wake up and it would just hit me. It would just hit me like a hammer in the gut. You know, all of that pain, you know, all of the fear I had of living, just being hit in the face every morning with a world that didn't make any kind of sense to me. You know, nothing that anybody did made any sense. Not only did I not know why I should be alive, I didn't understand why anybody would want to. There wasn't anything in the world that I could see that I wanted. If you'd have handed me $1 million and a Mercedes-Benz, I couldn't conceive of anything being anything that could happen to me making things any better. You know, I just thought they should wipe the whole earth out of existence because it just was, there wasn't anything that I could say, if I had this, it would be okay. If I had a lover, uh-uh. You know, I knew that wasn't going to make any difference. If I had a different family, uh-uh. You know, I knew. I just knew that nothing was ever going to change for me, and it was that way forever. And the things that happened to me as a result of my drinking, the material things that happened did not get through to my mind on their own because I was so fogged out and I was so just covered up with this, you know, with this fog that gets in your head, you know, so that when even when you're not using the chemicals, you still have that foggy feeling and it doesn't ever go away and you don't have to experience anything, you don't have to feel anything, you don't have to know what kind of a person you are. And so these things just went by and my family became more and more upset, and finally about a year before I got sober, my mother and father started going to Al-Anon. At this time, we had absolutely no relationship whatsoever. We didn't speak to each other. We lived in the same house, and if we spoke to each other, the conversation went like this, that I would come in the house, and my mother would start screaming at me because I had done something wrong that day that had been reported to her from some authority figure or another, and she would start screaming at me, and I would just sit there, and I would grit my teeth. And when the anger would start to come on me, I would grit my teeth and grit my teeth as long as I could. And then I would either start screaming at her or I would walk out of the house. And one way or another, I always wound up getting loaded. You know, I had to. And I blamed it on that. You know, I blamed it on the fact that they didn't understand. I blamed it on the fact that nobody understood. I went to the counselors and I really tried to tell them the truth. I went to everybody and I just tried to tell them, you know, but how can you explain? You know, you go in there and you say, well, nothing's right. You know, everything just is bad. And they go, well, you know, and they start talking to you about your mother and talking to you about, you know, this and that. And I'm going, no, but no, you don't understand. Nothing is right. And it's just, it's like they don't know what to do with an alcoholic, and we don't know what to do with ourselves either. We don't know the magic thing that we can tell them that's going to have them, they're going to say to us, oh, now I know how to help you recover. We don't know how to say that. So we just keep on trying. And the relationship with my family was total nothing. My brothers and sisters were people that got in my way. I tried real hard not to be violent with them, but I got that way sometimes. And I really felt bad about it, and the worse I felt about it, the harder it was not to do it. And fortunately, they're all bigger than me now, so our relationship is real good. No, I think those things have been kind of healed over. But funny things started happening when my parents started going to Al-Anon. The AA literature started showing up on the back of the toilet. You can always tell when an Al-Anon is trying to get an alcoholic sober. I don't know how they know to put it on the back of the toilet, but that's a good place. Alcoholics spend a lot of time around the toilet, and if you want an alcoholic to read something, put it there. See, because we can read it, and we don't want you to know that we're reading it. And I can pick that thing up, and I can think, God, I'm not this bad, am I? And I can look through here and see all this stuff, and nobody knows that I'm doing it, see, and that makes it okay. And then I'll put it right back on there the exact same way so that nobody will ever know I picked it up. And next time I go in there, I'll do the same thing. You know? And I did that, you know, and I would read that stuff. And I never would let anybody know I was doing it. And they never said anything to me about that literature. They never said, Lisa, this stuff is here because we want you to read it because we think you got a problem. That's no way to get an alcoholic to do something. They just left it there like it wasn't any of my business. And as soon as an alcoholic sees something that isn't any of their business, they've got to jump right in the middle of it. So I jumped right in the middle of it. And my mind started being open just a little bit. I got the attitude that maybe AA was a good thing. You know, maybe if I was an alcoholic or something, maybe it would help me. And when I would read those things, I would think, I wish that I was an alcoholic. I really do. I would say, I wish I was an alcoholic, because I thought an alcoholic was somebody that was unhappy when they were drinking. And their problem was that they couldn't stop drinking, and that drinking was what made them unhappy. And then they went to AA, and you taught them how not to drink and do drugs and stuff. And then everything was okay for them. And then they came around AA to talk about it, about how it was okay now that they weren't drinking anymore. And that's what I thought it was all about, and I wished that I was an alcoholic, because then I could just stop drinking. I could stop using drugs, and everything would be okay, but I had tried to stop. And nothing changed. It seemed like it all got worse. It seemed like when I would stop and I would try to clean up my act and I would try to put things back together, you know, it just got worse. It got to the point where I would really rather have just stayed in oblivion than make any kind of effort to make things go right in the outside world at all, because it just seemed that it was just had no effect whatsoever. Things just continued to be lousy, and I felt worse sober than I did drunk. I felt 10 times worse. You know, when I was drunk, and I was aware during the last probably 6 months of my using, I was aware when I got stoned of how little it was doing for me. I was aware that I was in some kind of deal, you know, because my day would start out, I would get loaded as soon as I could on something, some kind of drug, you know, and whether it was alcohol or just whatever happened to come by. And then As soon as I woke up, I knew that it was a big emergency and I had to go get high right now. And then once I did it, I'd be all messed up and I wouldn't be able to do anything, and I'd think, oh, I gotta come off of this. I'm too drunk, you know, I'm all messed up, and oh, I wish I hadn't done that, and I wish that I could come off, and I'd go sit somewhere and I'd hide and I wouldn't want to be around people and I wouldn't be able to talk to anybody and I'd just be so messed up, and then I'd start coming down off of it and I'd get back where I could function again, and then the pain would hit me again, and I just have to go wipe myself out again. And no matter which way I was, whether I was in the state of being sober and in pain, or whether I was in the state of being numb and unable to function, whichever way it was, I always wanted to be the other way. You know, I was always, it was like this race. It was like I was in this big, big hurry of just going like this, trying so hard to get to where the thing was at that I was looking for, that mysterious thing that we're looking for. And every time I got there, it seemed to have just left. And that's how I felt. And my parents went to Al-Anon, and they changed their attitude, and they stopped doing some things that they were doing. They stopped screaming at me all the time. My mother started to talk to me in a different tone of voice. And took her a while, I guess, but I really noticed that. And there wasn't any way that I was going to let her know that I noticed that. But I noticed it. Because, see, the thing that was important about that for me is that when they stopped acting crazy towards me, then I didn't have that excuse anymore to go drink. When they started just accepting me, I had always said, you know, there's nothing wrong with my drinking. There's nothing wrong with my drinking. If you just accept it, just because I'm young, so I can't drink, you know. So what? If you just accept it, I just don't drink any different than anybody else. And if you just accept it, I'd be fine. So they quieted down. And I didn't have that excuse anymore, and it wasn't fine. They accepted my drinking, and it wasn't fine. Nothing changed for me. You know, I was just as miserable at my home when nobody was yelling at me and nobody was on my case as I was when they had been all the time. And I had to start looking at myself. You know, and I knew that they were going to Al-Anon. And they came up and they told me, Lisa, we know of a place where you can go to get sober, and it's a place for young people, and it's a hospital for alcoholics and drug addicts. And we want you to go there, but we're not going to force you to. And if you ever think that you need any help, just let us know. And they dropped it, and they did not mention it again. And I'm so very glad, because I think that if they had gotten on my case about it, I would never have availed myself of that opportunity. And I went on for about 3 more months after that, and I kept seeing, you know, I had always had blackouts when I drank, and my blackouts began to get not so black. You know, I don't know why this was, but I started to remember more of the things I did, and it started bothering me. You know, the only purpose that I was drinking at this time was just to get oblivion. I didn't get anything else out of it. I just wanted to black myself completely out. And as soon as I started drinking, it was just an obsession towards that goal. And I began to remember some of the things I did, and I would wake up the next day and I would be someplace and I would look around me and I'd think, you know, what am I doing here? You know, this really isn't how I wanted to live. And my pride and my ego and my big old wall of coolness began to break down, because I told everybody for so long, hey, I'm doing what I want to do. You know, I'm cool. You know, you just don't want me to do this because you're not cool. And I'd been telling everybody so long that I wanted to live the way I was living, that I had begun to believe it. And when that illusion began to break down, I was in a hell of a mess. Because how could I ask for help? How could I let all those people who I thought that I was fooling into thinking that I was doing what I wanted to do, how could I let those people know that I really wanted to be just like them? That was just too much for my ego to take. But one day it just got too much for me. And I went to my parents and I said, okay, you know, I'm ready to go to the hospital. And I went to that treatment center and decided I didn't like it, thought I could just come home to mom and dad and everything be okay. Well, see, now I'd admitted I had a problem. So now we were on different terms. And once I had acknowledged the fact that I had an alcohol and drug problem, they told me, listen, you know, you are going to straighten out or you're not going to live here. And I came home from that treatment center and I was in such a foggy state of mind that I still haven't exactly figured out what happened, because I got pretty messed up on the way home. But I was in jail the next day, and I thought, you know, I could just tell mom and dad, well, I decided I didn't like the place, and they got a court order on me, and for some reason I said something to the judge and wound up in jail. It was all my fault. They didn't do it.
And they wouldn't get me out. And
I sat up there for a week, and I was thinking. And I was going, you know, but I want to get high. I want to get high. That's all I want to do is get high. There's nothing else that I want. You know, there's nothing else that I want. Why would anybody want me to stop doing the only thing that felt good to me? And I had the illusion that this is something that I've talked to my mom about because she's in Al-Anon, and this is something that she told me is very important because a lot of people have this little communication problem with dealing with young people in the family that are alcoholic, that when my parents or anybody would talk to me about my drinking, they always emphasized the fact that I was too young, that I did not have the right because I was too young. And see, to me, anytime anybody would talk to me about my drinking problem, I would always say, well, I don't have a drinking problem. If I was 21 right now, they wouldn't be complaining. See, and they emphasized the fact of my age rather than the fact that I was not drinking in a normal manner for a person of any age. You know, and I was able to use that cop-out, see, because as long as I believed that I was just going to all of a sudden turn the magic age someday and everything would be okay, then I was not having to face anything about my drinking. And so, you know, I try to be real careful with that, you know, with other people. And also my mom's told me that she, you know, shares that in a lot of Al-Anon meetings, because a lot of the new Al-Anons that come in that have family members, you know, kids or something that are alcoholic, they say, you know, but they're so young, but they're so young. And, you know, if you told me not to do something just because I was young, I'd just tell you, you know, that wasn't a good reason for me. And while I was sitting in that jail, I started thinking, you know, why would anybody not want to quit drinking after all the things that have happened to me? You know, I can't even keep a job. I can't even get a job in Norman. I can't even get my act together enough to go get a stupid job mopping floors somewhere. I can't do it anymore. I don't know how. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to go out in public anymore. I'm sitting in jail and I can't get out. And my parents won't even come get me. And why don't I want to quit? There must be something wrong with me. You know, really, really wrong with me for me not to want to quit after all these things have happened. And I began to think, you know, maybe I really am an alcoholic. Maybe I really am. And they'd talked a little bit about God in that treatment center, not very much. But, you know, that was something that I hadn't had anything to do with for a long time. I had made the decision when I was about 12 years old, and I can remember the day and the exact circumstance that it happened, that I did not want any part of religion. I did not want any part of God, that as far as I was concerned, God was a story in a book somewhere, and I was throwing that book away. And I wasn't going to read that story anymore because it didn't make any sense. You know, I didn't understand how those people could talk about loving God and Father and us be His children, and then talk about, you know, the hellfire and damnation and all those things. None of those things made any sense. How could they talk about a loving Father that was going to throw you in the oven forever? You know, I couldn't understand that. And it seemed like that everything that God wanted me to do didn't seem to be any fun, you know. And I thought, God, all I want to do is be happy. You know, all I want to do is be happy. I know I'm not going to heaven. I know nothing good's going to happen to me in life. I just want to have some fun. I just want to feel good while I can. So I said, get out of here, God. You know, I don't want to hear any of that business. Y'all are just telling me that, so I'll be good, and I'll go to work, and I'll do my stuff, and I won't bother you. And I just don't want to do that. I just want to feel good. And I started thinking about God when I was in that cell. And I thought, you know, just about anything is better than what I'm doing. Just anything would be better than living the way I'm living. And I picked up this book that they had brought me while I was in there. They brought me a bunch of books to read and stuff, and it was this book about Jesus, except for some reason at that time, see, I didn't like that name. I didn't like anything about it. That was something that people held over my head to tell me how bad I was. That was what that name meant to me. It was something that people used to try and make me feel bad. And for some reason, when I picked up that book, it just seemed to be a story about a man. And that man was the kind of guy that he really had a good life. See, he had something going for him. And he felt real good and he felt real close to God. And he wanted to share that with other people. He loved those people, you know, and he wanted to go and carry the message to them. And he didn't carry it to good people. You know, he didn't carry it to those people that went to church every Sunday. You know, he didn't figure that he needed to do that. He went and he found people, you know, like a couple of prostitutes, and he went and found, you know, some people that were tax collectors and, you know, kind of sleazy type of dishonest dealing people, and he went and carried the message to them. And that was different from what I had always heard in church. You know, I had always heard that God loved the good people. You know, God loves the good people. He hates the bad people. And to me, what I read in that book, it said God loves the bad people. You know, God loves people like me. And see, this guy, when he carried this message to these people, they felt so good after he did that that they wanted to turn around and help some other people. And they just devoted their whole lives just to doing that, just to going around and helping people. And that sounded real neat. Because all I'd ever really wanted, you know, was just to be of some use to somebody. I just didn't feel like there was any point to me being alive. What could I do? What good was I? You know, I was just like a rock sitting there. I had no more effect on the world. I had no more function or purpose than that rock. And I thought, you know, if I could just do something to make somebody else feel good, I've always wanted to. And whenever I tried to do it, it would always backfire. Because, see, I would see the action, and I would imitate the action. I would imitate the outside. I would try to do the outside things that you did to try and help other people or love other people. And I didn't know that it had to come from inside. I didn't know how to do that. I'd never had that experience. And I prayed in that cell. And I don't really remember exactly what I said. But I said something like, you know, God, I'd really like to live like those people live. And I'm getting, you know, sick of doing what I'm doing. And I'm about ready to give up and just kill myself. But if you think that there's some use for me in this world, if you'll just show me what it is, I'll do anything. And I remember saying that, and I got on my knees, and I'd never been on my knees before in my life. And I got on my knees, and I said that prayer, and I said, God, I'll do anything. And I really didn't feel a whole lot better. And I went back to treatment, got out of jail, and went back to treatment. And I really didn't feel a whole lot better there, except for that I had a little bit of hope. You know, I thought, just maybe, if I stay sober, maybe I'll be able to be the kind of person that's worth living for. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walked in, and all of those people there thought that I must feel different. And I did at first until they started talking. And when they started talking about their experiences, when a lady would get up and she would talk about how neat it was just to be able to look people in the eye. And I'd never heard anybody talk like that before. See, I knew that if you people knew how important it was just to be able to look people in the eye, you knew how I felt. You knew how it felt not to be able to do that. And you would talk about the things that happened to you. And I felt for the first time like I belong somewhere. The very first time in my whole life, and there wasn't maybe but two people in that meeting that was under 35, and I was 16. And I would put my head down on the table, and I would act real mean, and I would act real cool, and I would act any way I thought I could to try and keep you away from me. And I wouldn't let you see my face during those meetings because I didn't want you to know that I was listening. And sometimes I would start to cry, and I didn't want you to know that either. And for probably about the first month, I went to AA about once a week. And I didn't get a whole lot of good feelings out of it, but when I went to those meetings, I would hear things that made me have hope, you know? I wasn't doing anything for myself. I wasn't working a program. I was just looking around and trying to see if there was something there. And of course, I was gritting my teeth and staying sober, and that doesn't work very long. Sooner or later, I had to go and have what I hope is my last drunk.
I used some drugs. And I came to an AA meeting that night, and I asked somebody to help me. You know, and I wasn't real sure what it was that I was going to do or what I was going to get, but I decided I wanted to try it. And I began to make this woman that I asked to help me began to show me. The best I can explain what she tried to show me is she tried to show me how to apply the steps to the thing that I was concerned about, my material life. She showed me how to apply the steps, how to act like a normal human being, and how to use the program to help me do that. And I absolutely felt within 3 months, you know, I was so grateful for what I had been given, because I knew somebody was teaching me from square one how to live at last. You know, somebody was telling me what kind of clothes to wear someplace. Somebody was telling me, when you say this and this to somebody, it's going to hurt their feelings. You know, why don't you say this and this instead and see if that works better? Nobody had ever told me things like that before. They always got angry at me for the things I said, you know, or told me that I was rude, but they never told me what to do instead. And so I learned how to be more social with people, and I could have friends. And the most important thing that happened in my early days of Alcoholics Anonymous was this woman told me, if you stay sober, you're the only one here that can help those other young people that come in. You have to stay sober so that they will have someone to talk to. See, because she knew that deep down inside, I didn't think I was worth a damn. I wasn't important enough for me to stay sober for. If you had promised me everything in the world, I wasn't an important enough person to make it worthwhile. To me, myself, I was not that important to me. But when you told me that if I stayed sober and I made myself an example and I made myself a good life, that somebody else could share in that good life too as a result of the help that I gave them, that just set me on fire. You know, for the first time in my life, somebody said, here's what you're good for. Here's something for you to do that will help the rest of us. You can be a part of this family. You can be needed here. We need you. Go do it. Go to work. And I just went to work. And I worked the steps. I worked them to the best of my ability. And I developed a relationship with God that worked for me for some time. And it was a limited relationship, but it was all I required for a few years. And I learned how to be responsible. I got back in school. I was able to complete my education and go to work. I kept one job for 2 years, my first job that I had after I got out of high school. And I was earning pretty good money by the time that I quit working and went back to school again. And I learned how to do those things. I learned how to dress. I learned how to act. I learned how to be like a normal person. I learned how to pray to God. I learned what to pray for. I learned how to read the big book. You know, I learned how to work with others. I learned how to get them to AA meetings. And I learned how to live the program on the outside. And to a certain extent, I learned how to live it on the inside too, but there was a part of me that was still lonely and dying. See, because I didn't have that relationship with God. I didn't have that personal relationship with God. I did not have a total dependence upon the God of my understanding. I didn't know how to do that. And this woman couldn't teach me how to do that because she didn't have it herself. And she had a lot of things going for her. And she helped me just tremendously. And she's helped an awful lot of other people. But she could not teach me how to get that gift because she did not have it. And it was such a beautiful experience every time that I wake up to some new piece of knowledge in the AA program. It was like that when I came in and I learned that I really was equal to everyone else, that I was not a deformed being, you know, that I had the capacity to go out in the world and live just like the rest of you. It was beautiful for me to find that out. It was the first time I'd ever known that in my whole life. Finding out that I had the capacity to help another human being was beautiful. And every time I come to a new understanding, even though I have to go through pain to get there, when I come to the understanding, it's just really neat. And that was kind of the experience I've had with this. I was thinking for some reason when Tom was talking last night about what makes a person human. What makes me a human being? Because I've been, people tell me in AA, I'll get emotional and I'll cry and I'll be upset or something and I'll be hurting and I'll think, oh, I'm so ashamed of myself. And somebody will tell me, what are you ashamed of? Being human? You know, don't be ashamed of that. And I thought, what makes me a human being? You know, what really is it that makes me different from a chimpanzee? You know, because they have chimpanzees in the zoo now and they're teaching them to read and write and talk and, you know, with little sign languages and do all these kind of things that we used to think, you know, only people could do. And they're learning how to do all this stuff, but yet, deep down inside, I know that that chimpanzee is never going to become a human being, no matter if they learn how to read the Webster's Dictionary. Why is that? Why do I know that? What is it that makes me and you human? And because animals, they even have feelings of affection. You know, they reach out for contact. They get lonely. You know, any of us that's ever had, you know, a pet or something like that knows that, that they need contact. They need security of having another being there. And I thought, you know, the only thing I have ever done that they can't train a chimpanzee to do is pray to God. I don't think you can ever teach anybody but a human being how to look for something that nobody has any way of telling us that it's there. Nobody has any way of walking up to me and saying, here's God. It's something that I have to find deep down in my own self. And I think that what happened to me is that very slowly, the things that stood in the way between my heart and between God were removed from me. And the things that I had begun to take pride in my sobriety, were removed from me. I had learned the ability to relate to people. That began to be removed from me. I had learned the ability to, you know, to go to work and be responsible and be able to gain praise, you know, in my job, and that began to be removed from me. I had learned how to work with others, and I had learned how to help other alcoholics, and that began to be removed from me. Because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was still my higher power. And I believe today that God, working in my life, directly took those things from me so that I would go seek them again from Him. That I would seek them where they really come from. And one day, I was standing in a bookstore in Birmingham, Alabama, all by myself in a strange town, and I didn't know anybody. And I didn't have anybody to hang on to. And I noticed that I felt okay. I noticed that it wasn't important that I was there and that there wasn't anybody that I knew there with me. And I noticed that when I went to an AA meeting in that town that those people loved me, you know, just because I was me. And they didn't know anything about me. They didn't even know that I'd been sober 4 years. They didn't care. They would have loved me just as much as if I'd been sober one day and didn't know a damn thing about anything. And that really felt good. They didn't care if I knew anything, if I could do anything, if I could function, if I could work, if I had a job. They were just nice to me and they told me to come back. And I had the opportunity to experience that again with some time behind me in the program, and I saw, you know, it's me. It's really okay just to be what I am. I don't have to prove anything to anybody. And I was standing in that bookstore and I don't really know what happened. But I walked out of that bookstore and God was everywhere. It was like somebody had just taken and opened my eyes. And there wasn't anything I could do, any person I could talk to, where it did not seem like God was looking out through their eyes. And I felt like God was looking out through my eyes at them. And everywhere I went, even the streetlights, even the little cars looked like they were smiling. They all looked like they had faces, their little headlights. And I'd think, well, God bless you, you know? And I just went around dinging like that for a while. And I had that direct experience of God's love. And I had to wait 4.5 years in the program for it. If I had expected that when I came in, I might not have hung around 4.5 years to wait for it. But see, I didn't expect that. I didn't know it was there. So I was just there waiting. I was just waiting for the time when I would be prepared sufficiently for that love to enter my life. And I didn't even know that that was what I was waiting for.
There's a little contingency on that too. I was unable to function with that experience. I didn't know how to incorporate that into my life. I just kind of sat around and acted dingy all the time. And when I tried to direct and use that feeling I had, I began to try to control it. And when I tried to control it, I hung on to it, it went away. You can't squeeze it to death, you know. And so it went away, and I thought, well, what did I do to get that? How did it get there? And it wasn't ever a question of whether or not that feeling was going to come back again. I knew it. And I know today that I can have that feeling whenever I want it, that nobody in God's world has the ability to take that away from me. I had looked for that feeling in people. I had looked for it in men. I looked for it in alcohol. I looked for it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Have any of you ever had the experience of walking into an AA meeting and being in a bad place and sitting in that AA meeting and not getting anything out of it? I think we've all kind of had that experience once in a while, where we sit in that meeting and we don't feel any better than we did when we walked in. That's not the AA meeting's fault. You know, that's me and my relationship with God that makes that happen. Alcoholics Anonymous, you could bring all of Alcoholics Anonymous in one room and put it in here and try and make them get me out of a bad place. And they can't do it unless I open myself up to that experience. Now, it's like I want to ask myself, why don't I just open myself up to that experience of God loving me all the time? But see, whenever I'm out of it, I think, gosh, you know, that really felt good, but, you know, I had to go around sharing it with people all the time, and it took up so much time, and I really, maybe I want to do something for me for a change, and that's how I lose it, you know, because it does. When that feeling comes over me, all I want to do is be the best whatever it is that I am at that time. I want to put my all into everything. You know, and sometimes I get selfish and I don't want to do that anymore. And then I lose it and I have to go get it back. A lot of miracles have happened in my life since I've been in the program. It's getting about time for me to quit, and I wish I could talk about them all. I'm going to talk about one thing that's happened to me just recently because I really feel strongly about it. And it's just been beautiful learning experience for me to see the power of God working in my life and see how strong the program of Alcoholics Anonymous really was. I've been sober for 6 years, and I've grown and changed and learned in most areas of my life. But in the area of relationships with the opposite sex, I had not had any growth in that area because I had not had any pain really in that area. I came into the program with the attitude that, you know, I didn't know anything about it. And I learned about love, and I learned about these feelings that we have for another person in the AA program. I learned them with women and I learned them with men, but I learned them in the AA meetings and I learned them in Alcoholics Anonymous on that kind of basis. And I was comfortable with those feelings as long as they were on that basis. But I did not see what those feelings had to do with one person being a man and another person being a woman. I didn't understand the connection between those two things. Now, I knew about sex, and I was real comfortable with that. And as far as I was concerned, that was part of my life, too. But I didn't understand what those feelings of love had to do with these other feelings over here. And I thought, you know, everybody else in AA understands this. And people come to me that I sponsor and they want to talk to me and they say, this guy just blew me off and I just feel horrible. And I'm looking at him and I'm going, well, what's the big deal? Why don't they just go find another guy? You know? And I knew that I could not understand what they were going through. And it began to bother me. And I didn't understand why I was not able to have this experience. And I thought, maybe I'm just not capable of having these feelings. Maybe I'm just not made that way. And I was okay with that. And then I came to a discovery about 6 months ago that I had not taken any risks in my sobriety. I had always stayed around people that were perfectly willing to tell me all the right answers. And I was perfectly willing to do whatever they told me. And sometimes it went good and sometimes it went bad, but it was always safe. And I would never do anything unless I was absolutely sure. And I wouldn't ever love you unless I was absolutely sure. You know, it was okay if you were a newcomer because I knew you needed me. You know, it was okay if you were somebody that, you know, that had to ask me for something. If you needed something that I had, if you needed my sobriety, if you needed to stay in my house, if you needed to some food, then I could love you because you needed something from me and I was sure. It wasn't a risk. It was secure. And I didn't know how to just experience those feelings. And I became aware of this. I became aware that I needed people to need me. I became aware of the fact that I did not take any risks. And I made a decision about 6 months ago that some of you may think that this is absolute insanity. And I would have thought so probably a couple of years ago. I feel like it's been one of the most positive things that I've done in a long time. And I was just thinking about men. And I was thinking about, you know, they're just people too. You know, to me, somebody's a person first and then a man and a woman. And I'm just not understanding, you know, well, why do I have so much trouble with this dating stuff? You know, why can't I just kind of flow with it like other people seem to do? Why do I let these people get close to me and then they fall in love with me and I don't have any feelings and then I have to go, ah, get away. Why does that happen? I don't want that to happen anymore. I don't want to hurt these people anymore. I tried staying out of relationships for long periods of time. Didn't work either. You know, not only did it make me not close to men, it separated me from other women too, because I would push that area out of my life, and to most people that's very important. So I decided, I was standing in a store and I saw this little bracelet. It's got a rainbow on it and a unicorn, and I thought, I'm going to buy this bracelet, and this bracelet is going to be my risk bracelet. And it's going to be just like a desire chip. And do y'all have desire chips here, 24-hour chips? I don't see anybody nodding their head. You do? Well, like what they say about, you know, if you decide you want to take a drink, you got to throw it away if you decide to take a drink. And that's what I was going to do with this bracelet. This was going to be my risk bracelet. And in every area of my life, I said, God, okay, I'm putting it all in your hands. And when I say that serenity prayer, I'm going to pray just as much for the courage to change as I am for the serenity to accept. The serenity to accept is more comfortable most of the time, but sometimes I have to have the courage to change. And I put this bracelet on and I said, okay, God, anytime I come to a situation where there's two paths that I can choose, and there's going to be one that I know about, and there's going to be one that I don't know about, I'm going to try that one that I know about at least once. And if you close the door in my path and you say no, then I'll go back this other way and I'll have the serenity to accept. But I'm taking every risk that you put in my path from now on. And if I don't do it, I'm going to throw the bracelet away. And I wore it every day. And anytime there came a situation, I said, God, you know, I have this problem with men, you know. It's not, I don't have a problem with men. Men are fine. I have a problem with feelings. I have this problem. And I'm putting it in your hands. And I've followed everybody's set of rules that I know how to follow. And in the big book it says that God alone can be the final judge, that we turn to Him for guidance in this area. And I've listened to everybody. I've listened to young people and I've listened to old people and I've tried to do what everybody's told me to do. And none of those things has worked. I still keep hurting people, and I don't know why. So God, next time that I see a man walk by, I'm going to do whatever comes into my head to do. And you just see to it that you put the right thing in my head. And I came into a period of about the most craziest 3 months in my whole life. And I've made some mistakes, and I've hurt some people, and I've had to make some amends, and I've been able to go make those amends. But I also experienced those feelings for another person. And I was able to experience them with somebody that didn't need me, that it was just free. You know? And
I really thought that,
God, this is really neat. It was like when I was with this person, it was like praying all the time.
And I came to understand what it said in the 12 and 12 about having a spiritual and mental attraction for a person of the opposite sex. I used to look at that and I used to think, oh, bull, how can you have a spiritual attraction, you know?
I just figured it was all physical one way or another. It was all physical or else it was just loneliness and insecurity. I understood those things. But I had the opportunity to be with somebody that could share my experience of God consciousness with me. And I'm so grateful for that. And we had a good 3 weeks, and we had a bad 30 days, and it come to an end Friday a week ago, about this time of day. And I sat there and fell apart. I mean, I totally lost it. And I was scheduled to go speak at a conference, and I was sitting in this guy's office crying my fool eyes out, and he just said, well, you know, it's just not working anymore. And I knew that, but I just didn't want it to go away, you know. So I get in the car and I'm going down to this conference, and I thought, I'm going to die. I'm just going to die. I haven't felt this bad since my first 3 months of sobriety. What do you do? Nowhere in the book does it tell me what to do. What to do? I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm going and I'm talking to people. So I kept praying. And I laid there all night. And I said, God, you know, I might drink over this. And I really thought about it. See, because drinking is still an option for me one day at a time. It will never be a successful option. If I choose to drink, I choose to die. And I know that because I've taken the first step. But when I come into every morning, I ask God to help me not take a drink that day, because I know that there's always a possibility that I will. And I felt bad, and I thought about killing myself. And I got up the next morning, and I looked like that you just rolled me out of a Dempsey dumpster. I looked so bad. And I'm at this conference, and I'm the speaker, right? You know, and I'm losing my deal all over the place, and I don't have anything, and I don't know anything. And I started going and talking to people. And there's something about alcoholics when they talk to other alcoholics where you go up to an alcoholic and you tell them, I have this problem, see, this relationship ended, and it hurts so bad. And they'll start saying, yeah, it really does. I know. It feels real bad. And they'll start telling you about something that happened to them. And pretty soon you're both talking about how really bad it is. And then one of you will say, but the good thing about it is I learned this and this and this. And that's what I started doing. And it worked so well the first time I tried it, I thought I'd try it again. So I'd call everybody I saw and I'd say, man, this really terrible thing just happened to me and it's awful. And then they'd say, oh yeah, that really is bad. And then I'd say, but I learned this and this and this and this. And my list of things that I learned and my list of good things that I got longer and longer all the time. And it didn't just make the hurt go away just instantly. There's still some hurt there, you know, but the gratitude is greater. It was funny. I was talking to my mom about that. She's an Al-Anon. She came over one night when I was really hurting over this and I was feeling really bad and sat with me for a couple hours. And it's different when you talk to somebody that's not an alcoholic. You go and talk to somebody that's not an alcoholic and you say, oh, it's really bad, it's terrible. And they say, no, it's not, it's really good. Look at this and this and this. And you're going to argue with them. See, because an alcoholic's going to contradict. When an alcoholic's in a bad place, they're going to fight whatever they see in front of them. If you try and tell the alcoholic all the good stuff, they're going to say, no. It's like I go and I talk to this close friend of mine, and she says, God, Lisa, you know, I'll bet you just want to give up. And I'll go, no. And it's just the way our minds work, you know. And it's really good to be sober today and that I have a new area of my life that I can share experience in. And the most important thing that I have learned from that whole experience is that trusting God totally and completely works. It works. I used to think that there wasn't any way I could get to God directly. I used to think that I had to ask one of you what God's will was for me or I wouldn't have any way of knowing it. I've looked and looked at that big book. I've read that 10th and 11th step over and over again. It tells me how to put
the power of God into my life, and nowhere in there does it say I ask another human being what God's will is for me. It says when we first come into contact with this power, we're going to make mistakes. We're probably going to think that we have it all the time, and we're going to think that we're inspired all the time. We're going to do a bunch of crazy stuff, and it's going to be self-will. But that's okay. It goes away after a while. You get practice at it, and it gets better. And that's what's been happening to me. When I was finally willing to take the risk to totally and completely trust God in my life, two things have happened. Is that I don't go around looking like Miss Sobriety all the time anymore because I make a bunch of mistakes. But man, I feel real good most of the time. You know, and when I feel bad, I feel real bad. But at least I feel, and at least I've got you to come share with. I don't have to know anything to be up here talking. You know, the only thing I know is just what I've told you. God loves me, I'm sober, and that's it. You know, and it's just, I never know how to end these things because you always feel like you're supposed to say something really neat, and the neat things never seem to wind up in my mouth right at the end. But the one thing I do want to say is that I'm so grateful for y'all having listened to me here. Because I need to say these things as much as you need to hear them. My experience of sharing with others is the way that I reinforce what I already know. I don't believe that just working with others is enough. I used to believe that. I don't believe that just sitting in my room and praying and being close to God is enough. I believe that those things are tied together in such a way that they work okay by themselves, but together it's like you mix two chemicals together and there's just this big explosion. And you've given me everything I have. You know, I'm going to college now. I'm living a normal life. That was what I wanted when I came into AA. But you've given me so much more than I wanted. You've given me the capacity to feel and the capacity to share and the capacity to walk through fear and come out the other side of it and know that it's okay to be a fallible human being. It's okay to be imperfect. God created me that way. He must love imperfect people because He sure made a lot of them. And I'm just really glad to be alive. It's going to be a good conference. And I'm ready to go swimming, so I think I'll shut up. Thank you.
Lisa, I'd like to give you this gift from the Fellowship by the Sea.
Thank you. It's Christmas. I bet I know what this is. It's a beer mug. I swear I don't understand this, but, you know, maybe this is just to remind me what I used to be like. Thank you.